From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Dr. Brian McPherson is a professor in the Civil and Environmental Engineering Department at the University of Utah. He was recently awarded a $1.3 million grant from the Department of Energy to study whether or not the process of carbon capture and storage, or CCS, could be applied here in Utah.
Specifically, the project will investigate potential CCS sites near two coal-fired power plants here in Utah. In Emery County, the 1,320-megawatt Hunter Power Plant near Castledale and the 895-megawatt Huntington Power Plant near Huntington.
What is carbon capture and storage? What are its benefits and challenges of first introducing and then storing carbon dioxide into the ground? And once there, will it remain there in perpetuity?
Professor McPherson joins us in the first part of the show today to explain this technology, his upcoming study, and answer our questions.
Hey, then in the second half of the show, we're going to give you some news items, including a,
highlights and lowlights.
Yeah, as usual, and including a story about a princess. The Princess Cruise Line, and specifically a $40 million fine recently handed down to Carnival Cruise Line, or Princess Cruise Lines, for discharging millions of gallons of untreated wastewater from their cruise ships into international waters, otherwise known as the Seven Seas.
We'll also be talking about Bishop's recent meeting with the Trump administration, asking them to consider eliminating the national monuments here, undoing the national monuments here in the state of Utah.
Why not?
It's all on the table.
Yeah, it's all, you're right. No, it's all on the table, and it's all here on This Green Earth. We'll get started with our first guest right after these messages from our underwriters.
Stay Rocky tuned. Mountain Power is proud to support KPCW and This Green Earth. Rocky Mountain Power offers Watt Smart advice, such as avoiding the use of large appliances like a washer or dryer between 2 and 8 p.m. It helps reduce energy demand and keeps costs down for all of us. More ways to save energy at wattsmart.com.
Burr, another holiday is fast approaching at Park City Nursery. We are happy to celebrate the changing season with KPCW, offering a selection of fresh field-grown Christmas trees, handmade wreaths and garland, decorations, candles, gifts, and a cup of hot cider. A family tradition since 1983, parkcitynursery.com.
This is Brenda with Republic Services, your local provider for recycling and garbage collection. Information about what is acceptable to put in your curbside recycling bin can be found at summitcountyrecycles.org. Please help Summit County be clean. Remember to recycle.
Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
And joining us on the phone is our first guest. He is Dr. Brian McPherson. He's a professor in the Civil and Environmental Engineering Department at the University of Utah. And and Brian, just were recently awarded by the Department of Energy a $1.3 million grant to study, basically, I guess, the feasibility of employing carbon capture and storage, or CCS, at a couple of power plants here in Utah. And Brian will give us some details on what that grant and the study is all about. First of all, Dr. McPherson, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much. It's truly an honor for me to join the show this morning.
Thanks. Let's start with some background on the technology or the process called carbon capture and storage. There's a lot there to unpack. Give us a little background on that.
There really is. I've been studying this process for, good gosh, it's almost 20 years now. And 20 years ago, carbon capture and storage was not a household word like it is today. In fact, only folks in Europe were examining it, and the National Academy of Science started examining it about 20 years ago. And the basic premise is to capture CO2, ideally from the air, because we've got increasing carbon concentration in the atmosphere. But given the truly tremendous expense of capturing it from the air with filters and the like, which do exist but are very expensive, the idea is to capture it from point sources such as power plants, coal-fired power plants in particular, which a typical large-scale power plant like the Hunter power plant, which is one of our proposed sites, can produce about 10 million tons of CO2 per year. So the idea is to capture the flue gas, separate the carbon dioxide from that, which requires an intense chemical process with a high energy penalty, and then inject that carbon dioxide into deep subsurface, because after all, that's where the CO2 came from to begin with. The fossil fuels contain a lot of CO2, and restoring that CO2 is the basic premise. And when I received a phone call literally 20 years ago from my advisor, who was on the National Academy of Sciences, he said, "Brian, you really need to get into carbon capture and storage." And when he explained it to me, I was like, what a silly idea. Why not just convert to nuclear power or something like that? But here I am 20 years later and working on it quite intensely.
I would say safely, not so silly anymore, huh, Brian?
The concept of base load escaped me at the time.
Right.
Why not just replace it with geothermal and solar and other renewables? But it's a really complicated issue technically but especially economically.
Well, I was just about to mention that it seems so complicated to put carbon dioxide back in the ground. And then how does it stay there, or does it stay in the ground in perpetuity?
It really does, unless there's a pre-existing or a newly created pathway to the surface, or, for example, an abandoned oil well or something like that. It won't make its way back up to the surface without a high permeability, high open pathway, so to speak, geologically. And that's really difficult because of the intense pressures of the Earth's crust. It really tends to close up faults and fractures and even well bores, if it's at all possible, just because of the intense pressures. And, it requires a lot of energy to inject CO2 in the subsurface because it flows very slowly through the subsurface. Water, all fluids, liquids, gases alike, flow very slowly in the subsurface. And so even if it does find a pathway to the surface, it will flow very slowly to the surface. So the risks of leakage are fairly small, but even if it does leak, the leakage rates will be fairly small because, again, it takes a lot of it's just a really slow process. So it's effectively can stay and will stay in perpetuity except for those very small leaks. Now, that's what my research, right, a lot of folks' research suggests. Of course, there's major natural CO2 reservoirs in the subsurface that kind of prove it by analog.
Okay, so I want to try to visualize here how the CO2 goes from, let's say, the coal-fired power plant, the stack, let's say, eventually down into this reservoir. You have all this carbon dioxide that would normally come out of the stack at some set concentration. We know Nell and I are always talking about how the atmosphere's general concentration now of CO2 is around 400 parts per million. But what's coming out of the stack is safely tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of parts per million of carbon dioxide.
Oh, yes, yes. The concentration is tremendous. As I suggested, mentioned before, the Hunter power plant, almost 10 million tons of CO2 per year. So it's pretty significant, but in terms of the overall concentration, all of those sources plus automobiles and every other process that creates carbon dioxide just inches up the atmosphere, which is huge in comparison, small numbers of parts per million per year, but that does have a big impact on temperature.
Right, but it's not as simple as redirecting what would otherwise go down out the stack just down into the ground. Don't you have to first filter out all the other impurities that are also coming out, the nitrogen-based compounds, the sulfur-based compounds, the metals that are also emitted out of the coal, the power plant stack?
Yes, So the so-called SOXs, the sulfur compounds, the NOXs, the nitrogen, and then mercury and other metals. So it's, and then there's soot and everything else that goes with it. It's pretty nasty stuff. And you could just take that flue gas by itself and inject it into the ground. I mean, that's not in a regulatory context, but technically you could just take it. But the problem with that is that sulfuric acids and also all the other nasty stuff in there would really wreak havoc in the subsurface chemically. And the EPA recognizes that. Decades of research have suggested that it's imperative to strip that to the that flue gas to its purest form, about 95 to 97% pure CO2, and that's very expensive.
Okay.
It it involves a parasitic power load on the power plant, and that penalty can be upwards of 30%. A typical number is around 30%, and it can be higher than that. So the energy cost alone, not to mention the capital cost for the equipment necessary to strip the flue gas of all that other stuff and purify CO2 is tremendous. For a retrofit on an existing power plant can exceed $300 million.
Wow.
So that's cheap. That's a cheap retrofit. A brand new power plant, as I understand it, can be without carbon capture, can be approach $1 billion,
right,
or more, depending on the size. And you can count on that being 1.5 to 2 times that cost when you install the carbon capture. Now, don't take these numbers at heart. These are just round numbers I'm tossing out because there's so many different options to possibly utilize. But the parasitic power load, along with the capital cost, means that we're looking at possibly round numbers, a doubling of your utility bill, and that's just too much for the public at large to stomach. It's really my father, when he sees his power bill go up by $10 in a month, he's walking around ranting and raving for an hour. It's like, okay, well, let's not double it. So,
with all of that in mind, is this technology, you know, economically feasible?
Economically, it's feasible only if some incentive is put in place so that that the cost is not passed directly to the consumer of electricity completely, because that is where you see the doubling of the power bills. If it's a broad-based, be it a carbon tax or a carbon cap and trade system, that's probably the way to go, because then it softens, it spreads the cost over multiple sectors. Now, that said, the only country in the world that has carbon capture and storage for the pure purpose just of storing carbon, not for producing energy such as enhanced oil recovery and the like, is Norway. And that country is one of the few countries that has such a carbon tax. Most other countries utilize a cap and trade system. And so that kind of, just figuratively speaking, it suggests the power of the carbon tax, which is also not a popular term.
Correct. We're speaking with Brian McPherson. He is a professor down at the University of Utah in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering. We're talking about carbon capture and storage and a grant, a $1.3 million grant he just recently received from the Department of Energy to study the feasibility of CCS at two power plants here in the state of Utah, the Hunter Power Plant and the Huntington Power Plant. So, Brian, give us a little information about what your study is going to involve.
Well, this particular study, as you mentioned, focuses on those two power plants. These are power plants built in the 70s and 80s, late 70s and early 80s, as I recall. And the Hunter Power Plant is the larger of the two. It produces almost 10 million tons per year, and the Huntington Power Plant produces about 6 million tons of CO2 per year. And these are coal-fired power plants, which are part of the broad base load providing power to Utah and other western states. And the EPA in recent years has been discussing a lot of options for reducing CO2 emissions, including shuttering coal-fired power plant because of the nature of those flue gases. So our study is to examine what's the feasibility, the practical possibility of capturing CO2 at one of these coal-fired power plants and storing the CO2 underground. The unique nature of this grant is that we will examine and study and really just really dig into the technical aspects, as you asked about earlier, but also the regulatory aspects. And we'll partner up with various carbon capture technologies. Actually, Rocky Mountain Power has already done that. So there's a line of different options that Rocky Mountain Power is examining for capture and those technical aspects, and then our role here at the University of Utah with all of our partners. We've got a really good team to examine just the storage part and the geological issues, including potential impacts on the deep saline brine that's the target of the storage, and then also pressures and other subsurface processes. So we'll focus really on the storage aspects, technical and non-technical.
Okay.
Now, with these two power plants that you're focusing on, have they been excited or receptive about, you know, working with you to study this, or is this something that largely will take place outside of those plants because you're focusing on storage?
Well, the Rocky Mountain Power and PacifiCorp have really embraced this project. I mean, they're very much in favor of, because they want to know with some certainty, and what are the uncertainties regarding the practical possibilities. So Rocky Mountain Power, we've toured the plant and we've toured the plant site multiple times in the past 6 months in preparing for the grant application. And they even let us include some photographs of the plant site, which is, you know, I think in the past there's always been some reluctance, which there is with most corporations, to open up the doors and really, you know, there's lots of safety issues and otherwise, but they've been really accommodating, and they're really excited about this project because it will help them make some decisions and provide some options to the Public Services Commission regarding the fate of these plants. And that's our goal, and that's the Department of Energy's goal. The Department of Energy is sponsoring this project and providing the grant.
And
DOE is really interested in knowing what are the options as well.
Well, one of the things that we've been hearing about, you know, is a decrease in power and energy coming from coal. And, you know, we hear about coal-fired power plants closing. So it sounds like carbon capture and storage might be an option to help keep them open. But what are the other applications of the carbon capture and storage? Is this only for coal-fired plants, or are you seeing it in other locations?
Well, it's also an option for natural gas plants, which produces a cleaner stream, so the capture is less expensive than with coal. And natural gas plants produce about roughly 50% CO2 per power unit than unit of power, so to speak, BTU or joule, than coal-fired power plants. And so the cost of capital cost and the ongoing capture costs are less, but also ethanol plants, which produce a fairly pure stream, almost no processing necessary, as well as fertilizer plants, for example. So the premise of our grant, the objectives, goals and objectives of our grant, is to examine the storage options, which would then be applicable to natural gas, ethanol, fertilizer, other stationary CO2 sources. And right now, there's other uses of CO2, food-grade CO2 for soda pop, for example, and other applications. But there's so much CO2 produced by all of these different sources that utilizing them for practical purposes is a stretch at this point.
Right.
Although, yeah.
Right. So it sounds like the real driver here, or the real limiting factor, is finding a storage location. So it really comes down a lot about the geology of what's beneath these two power plants. And if you find some, if you find a room, let's say, a reservoir, a cavern or so, how much will it hold, right? Because it has a finite capacity, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So
yes, it's definitively, I mean, oil and natural gas and coal have CO2 that's bound up in the, you know, the solid matrix or liquid matrix of those resources, those fuels. And when those fuels are produced, then that leaves pore space. It leaves, you know, it's removed from the subsurface. So the idea, at least with oil and gas reservoirs and coal seams, is to replace that pore space with pure CO2. The other option, which provides a lot more storage capacity, are these deep saline formations, which the water in these formations is far too salty, far too brackish and briny to utilize and clean up for drinking water. It's also very deep. We're talking 5 kilometers depth in some cases. But these reservoirs, these large saline reservoirs, are huge. I mean, they can accommodate literally hundreds of millions of tons. The requirement of this grant application was minimum 50 million tons, and the geology below the Hunter and Huntington plants can accommodate much more than that. It's our job to assess how far will that CO2 move away from the power plants given that capacity and over what period of time. But most power plants, most, not all, but most power plants have some capable candidate for storage deep underground, but it comes down to the cost. That's the real issue. The deeper it is, the higher the cost, and the different a different set of technical risks start to bear out when you go deeper.
Okay.
So at this point, it sounds like you're really looking at the opportunities on site for these power plants. Are you also exploring, you know, like sites further afield from these plants?
We definitely are, and that's another. The Department of Energy was very thorough in their application requirements. They required all applicants to propose a plan to examine not only on site but also off site, and to scale, you know, with respect to price and technical feasibility, the range of permutations, the range of options, and. The limiting factor there are pipelines, and we've all been hearing about the Dakota Pipeline and otherwise. Pipelines are a complicated issue because of rights of way, but also the cost. You're looking at upwards of $1 million per mile for a capable, high-capacity CO2 pipeline, so it can be fairly expensive to deploy a pipeline. Again, that adds on to the capital cost. So if pipelines can be avoided, then the PR issues, the right-of-way issues, the cost of those pipelines can be avoided.
All right. A couple more minutes. The DOE, like you say, has let out grants to other universities around the countries because there's a number of other studies going on in different areas of the country, correct?
Yes. 13 others were awarded funding for studies just like this, 16 in total, but 3 of those were much larger scale. So in CO2 capture and storage scenarios that are already operating, and the discussion or focus of those 3 grants is to examine long-term storage. So we're looking at the short-term, the life of a power plant. Those projects are examining the possibility and practicality of longer-term storage. These 13, which are roughly about $1 million to $1.5 million each, are in different regions of the country, different geological settings, different sources of CO2. So the Department of Energy is attempting to really cover all bases, so to speak.
All right. Well, I just want to say real quick now.
Go ahead.
we're getting lots of phone calls, Brian. No surprise. This is a very very controversial issue, topic, because it deals with coal here. And up here in Park City, we get our
hackles up when we start talking about burning coal. And that, so, but we don't take phone calls. Remember, we don't take phone calls here because we don't have a screener and we don't have a delay button for that moment times when we get some salty language. So we don't take.
We've learned that the hard way.
Yes, so. Brian, we learned that the hard way. But you are generating a lot of conversation. We may hear later. Go ahead now.
Well, I wanted to ask about the timeline for this study. You know, when do you expect to implement this and to start seeing results? How long will something like this take?
Well, the Department of Energy stipulated a very, in my view, a very short time frame. It's we need to be absolutely finished in 18 months. So we will start. In fact, I spoke to the project manager at the Department of Energy on Friday, and he suggested, you know, the contract won't be implemented till February, but he said, you know, you may want to start earlier, and if you can risk, you know, the cost of spending early and being reimbursed later, because you only have 18 months and we will not shift that deadline. You must be finished in 18 months.
Oh, wow.
And they'd like the bulk of the results finished end of 2017. So it's a very rapid turnaround, but on the other hand, probably my best ability has been assembling a team and a good team, and the people that will work on this are just top flight. So
right.
We'll do it.
All right, and you can remind your students, Brian, that you have deadlines too.
Indeed.
Your grade will be dependent on you meeting that deadline.
It's so. Quite the final exam for sure.
So, all right, well, Brian, where can people go to learn more about your study and what you do in the Civil and Environmental Engineering Department down at the U?
Well, right now, we've got one ongoing project in Texas, and that is probably the easiest website that you can access is swp.rocks, so swp.rocks. That is one of our current ongoing sites. Websites for an ongoing project of CO2 injection for oil recovery in Texas. That's the low-hanging fruit, is using CO2 for energy production. This project, the new one, we're just setting up the website literally today. One of its addresses, we'll have multiple addresses, is Carbon Safest, CarbonSafest.org, CarbonSafest.org. Mm-hmm. We will have this study, which again is deep saline only, posted up there soon. So lots of information.
All right. And we hope to have you back on somewhere around 18 months from now.
That's right. The end of 2017 on the nose.
Terrific. Sounds great.
All right. Brian McPherson is a professor at the University of Utah's Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering. And thank you again for taking the time to chat with us this morning on This Green Earth.
Thank you so much. I really, really appreciate it.
All right. Our pleasure. All right, Brian. All right, so let's take a break for a couple of underwriters and sponsors. When we come back, we've got some news items to cover.
That's
say,
right.
Say yes now.
We do. Could you not hear me nodding along with that? Yeah.
Yes, nod louder. All right. We'll be right back. This Green Earth.
Hi, I'm landscape architect Seth Bocholt, sponsor of This Green Earth on KPCW. Bocholt offers project management for site and landscape environments from vision to creation. We're at the corner of Kearns Boulevard in the Reed Building, 649-3856.
This is Chris Robinson with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. KPCW is one of the many nonprofits our agents and companies support. They are the backbone of Summit and Wasatch counties in our incredible community. More info at bhhsutah.com.
I'm Beth Lohman from Park City Mountain and supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain's Epic Promise grants and donations focus on youth programs and environmental initiatives that impact our local communities. Grants fund programs that are designed to help kids achieve in the classroom and develop an interest for the outdoors by engaging guests, local communities, and our employees. Information at epicpromise.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues, concept sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
And we have some news items we want to cover.
What's the first one now?
News item number one.
Yes.
Well, a couple weeks ago, you brought in a piece from the Wall Street Journal that was kind of talking about, regardless of policy changes, renewables are going to keep increasing. Coal is not going to have a big comeback. It's sort of a fuel of the past,
yeah,
if
based,
you will.
And I remind everyone, based on quotes from CEOs of both Duke Power and
right.
American Electric Power, two of the largest coal-burning institutions or power power companies in the country, who have said coal's not coming back. We're not going. We're not going to replace our natural gas-fired power plants with coal-fired power plants.
Right.
And we're probably not building new coal-fired power plants. Okay, but that's what.
Right. So it was. You know, it's not like this was sort of from a biased source.
This wasn't from the Sierra Club saying coal's not. No, this is from.
Right.
Okay.
So along those same lines, the NRDC, the Natural Resources Defense Council, released their fourth annual energy report.
Mm-hmm.
And the main takeaway is that, you know, they don't, much like this Wall Street Journal piece, they don't see this increase in renewables changing or coal you know, bouncing back. They say coal-fired generation dropped to historic lows this year, producing only one-third of our electricity, while renewable energy generation reached record highs, with more than one-eighth of America's electricity generated from solar panels, wind turbines, and other renewable resources.
Roughly 12%.
Right, 12%, which is like a significant amount to what we've been seeing, you know, in the past 5 or 10 years.
Right.
And it's only increasing. And this is kind of, this is due to economic factors. It's no longer really economically a great idea in most cases to, you know, launch a new coal-fired power plant, as you mentioned. So the director of the NRDC Energy Program just says the nationwide momentum for pollution-free energy is undeniable because clean energy now costs less than dirty energy. However, strong local, state, and federal policies are necessary for the United States to remain competitive globally and ensure clean energy technology and employment surge to the highest possible levels here within the United States, here at home. So I think their concern is, you know, we're not the only people transitioning to renewables. It's happening all around the world. And to get the economic advantage, we kind of need to jump on that bandwagon sooner rather than later.
You're right. We do. But guess who's going to rescind and revoke the Clean Power Plan? Our next administration.
Right, you know. Right.
So guess who's going to walk away from the Paris agreements, climate agreement? Our next administration.
So interestingly, though, because that was my first thought as I read this as well. Like, well, we can kiss this goodbye. Michael Grunwald, who's an energy policy specialist, has said that even if the United States... And he wrote this after the election. He said, even if the United States were to withdraw from the Paris climate deal, the U.S. is on track to fulfill its pledges under that deal, which was incredibly interesting. And I haven't read his specific piece, so I don't know if he's saying that'll be thanks to maybe state policies or the policies of large cities, or if that's just the economic direction that things are heading. So that'll be interesting to track.
I'll say.
But yeah, I mean, it's really inspiring or... heartening to hear things like
heartening.
That.
Heartening. Mm-hmm. And you heard that Al Gore met with our next president yesterday. I'd like to see the transcripts of that meeting.
Agreed.
That's interesting. Okay. So here's one interesting fact I got from a credible source, that China produces more carbon dioxide from its coal-fired power plants each day than we produce from all our fossil fuels that we burn, coal, natural gas, and oil. Say that again.
Wow.
We produce a lot of carbon dioxide in this country, right? We burn 20 million barrels, roughly, of oil a day. One quarter of all the oil, or 20% or so, roughly, of all the oil consumed on a global basis is burned in this country. So that's a lot of carbon dioxide right there. You add in the natural gas, carbon dioxide from natural gas, and the carbon dioxide from coal, that's less than what China produces just from its coal-fired power plants. So I wanted to ask Brian if China is pursuing CCS technology too.
We should have asked him about the international applications.
But anyway, that's
next time.
These are the numbers we're dealing with and the challenges we're facing. And China is, you know, is trying to be a player in this too. Although there are some articles that suggest they are, they could see an increase in coal-fired emission, carbon dioxide-based emissions from coal-fired power plants this coming year. That's another story. Anyway, that's the story from the NRDC.
Mm-hmm. Right. And just to leave it on a positive note, they say one in five Americans now lives in a state with a 50% renewable energy target.
Oh.
So, you know, again, it kind of
one
shows the power of those state or local
4 out of 5
initiatives. Mm-hmm.
Don't. And 100%, 100% of Utahns do not live in a state with that 50% goal.
Yeah. Okay. Right?
That's all right. That's our energy season. Let me take another break. We'll come back. You want to do the Princess Cruise Line story?
Yeah, I can't wait any longer to talk about
it. We got
to
read that. We have a reading.
Just read it.
We're
going to
do
finish.
Something new on this show. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Katie from Recycle Utah. Did you know Recycle Utah accepts white blocks of packing styrofoam? Please always recycle this non-biodegradable material at the recycling center. And if you are offered a styrofoam to-go container at a restaurant, politely decline it.
Recycle Utah is your local nonprofit recycling drop-off center, bringing water conservation ideas to you for now 25 years. We support KPCW and the idea of leading sustainable lives in Park City.
Hey, it's This Green Earth.
We're still here.
We're still here, and we're still covering some news items. This one is really interesting, though. And you're going to help me read this. We're going to do a little reading. It's like a bedtime story about a princess. Ready?
And we should mention that this is from the New York Times,
yes,
from December 2nd by Katie Rogers.
Oh, very good. Thank you. And I also have some information from the Attorney General's, U.S. Attorney's offices in Southern District of Florida who put out this press release. This is who, they did this work that we're about to describe. Ready? Here we go. Princess Cruise Lines has pleaded guilty to 7 felony charges and will pay $40 million after employees on a cruise ship were caught dumping oiled waste into the seas and lying to cover up their actions. This from officials of the Justice Department said federal authorities called it the largest ever criminal penalty for intentional vessel pollution.
In a statement released by the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of Florida last Thursday, officials said that employees of a cruise ship, the Caribbean Princess, used several tactics, including a device called a, quote, magic pipe, to circumvent water cleaning mechanisms and digital devices monitoring oil levels. Officials said that 4 other Princess ships were also found to have engaged in illegal practices to discharge waste. A magic pipe.
Yes, you right here. The discharged waste included gray water, water that has been contaminated with food particles, grease, and fat from the ship's galley. So that's like your food grinder in your kitchen.
Oh, your disposal.
Yeah.
In the sink.
Oh,
there
my
it
God.
Is.
Yeah, yeah. That's that type mm-hmm. of food waste. That's gray water. Also, when you take a shower or use water, you know, wash your hands, that can be considered gray water, mm-hmm. too. Black water is what we, the classic septic water. So this is gray water. And water, they also found water in the ship's bilge. That's the bottom part of the ship where oil waste from engines can accumulate. In one case, investigators on the Caribbean Princess found black oil. That's basically just motor oil, lubricant oil, in another valve that employees used to discharge waste.
We should also mention that as part of its plea agreement, ships from 8 of the parent company Carnival Cruise Lines will be under a court-supervised environmental compliance plan for 5 years and will undergo auditing. So that's in addition to the $40 million charge. Officials said these practices began in 2005 and persisted until August 2013, when a newly hired engineer on the Caribbean Princess observed more than 4,000 gallons of contaminated discharge being released into the ocean off the coast of England. He reported the practice to Britain's Maritime and Coast Guard Agency and quit when the ship reached Southampton.
He quit, right.
So he's the hero of the day.
Yeah,
here,
he's
I
the
think.
Hero. Yeah. Because how long has this been going on? Oh, since roughly 2005.
Right.
And how, 8 years. Not just one ship, multiple ships.
Mm-hmm.
Princess, this is important to note. Princess is a division of the Miami-based Carnival Cruise Lines, the largest such company in the world. And it gave the Caribbean Princess its debut in 2004, and the ship has traveled the world seas from ports in Texas to the coast of England. One motive for the dumping, no surprise, was to save money, because the cost of removing the waste properly from the ship is expensive.
No surprise there.
Right. That's typical.
Right.
But also no surprise, you finally get a whistleblower. Somebody stands up and says, I'm not going to be part and parcel of this activity. But it took almost eight years.
Right.
Okay. This magic pie. All right, go. What else do we have?
In a statement, Princess Cruise Line said it had launched its own internal investigation when the episode was first reported in 2013 and said that existing policies and procedures had not been enough to safeguard against the pollution. Princess also said that it had invested in better training, restructured operations, and spent millions of dollars to upgrade ship equipment.
Here's something from the we'll wrap this up in a little bit with you, but this is from the Justice Department website. Princess engineers on the Caribbean Princess indicated that the chief engineer responsible for the discharge, this one specific discharge on August 26, 2013, was known as the Italian Broccino Corto, a person with short arms. That's an Italian expression for a cheap person whose arms are too short to reach his wallet. Some expressed the same opinion of the shoreside superintendent. Back to the cost issue. It's cheaper just to discharge all this waste illegally out of its magic pipe than to store it and bring it to the port and discharge it properly there and pay a fee for that. This is what, and I also want to say, when we talk about Princess Cruise Lines, like say, it's they're owned by Carnival Cruise Lines. And I have, who else is it? Oh, shoot, now. It was right here. Caribbean Prince. Oh, I'll find it in a second. In any case, Holland America is also under Carnival Cruise Line. So
right.
All these cruise, is this an attitude? Is this a pervasive attitude throughout the cruise
industry?
Right.
Is this an anomaly, or is this something that we're going to slowly start to see again and again now that the spotlight's on it a little bit, I wonder. So we should also mention that if approved by the court, $10 million of the $40 million criminal penalty will be devoted to community service projects to benefit the maritime environment. $3 million to community service payments will go to environmental projects in South Florida. And $1 million will be earmarked for projects to benefit the marine environment in United Kingdom waters, where it was first reported. So,
Carnival Cruise Line also owns Holland America, Seabourn Cruise, and AIDA Cruises, along with Princess Cruises. So they all fall under the ownership of Carnival Cruise Line. So that's really amazing. Not surprising. You know, international waters, there's nobody there to monitor. This wasn't a result of someone, of a regulatory monitoring or something like that. This is a result of one guy back in 2013 who said, this is totally illegal. And I have some professional integrity and ethics. I'm reporting this, and I quit. Thank you. That's what it takes sometimes, and a lot of that. All right, let's take another break. When we come back, we got another story.
Yeah, we're going to talk about waterfowl in Utah, and
safe
we're going to talk about bishops meeting with Trump.
Safe areas. All right, it's this Green Earth. We'll be right back.
Miller Orthodontics supports KPCW and their involvement with area youth and teens. Speaking of youth, did you know Invisalign has a specific type of aligner just for teens? Over 3/4 of our Invisalign patients are 19 or younger. More information about Invisalign Teen is available at m2ortho.com.
Support for KPCW comes from Crandall Capital with New Park Town Center. With urban amenities and services and home to restaurants, shops, entertainment, lodging, and residences. More information about New Park Town Center at 801-303-5440.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
I'm Chris Cherniak.
And we have a local update relevant to our own home state here of Utah.
And our environment.
And our environment, unquote. Of course.
Yes.
What else on this green earth? We heard that Utah Representative Rob Bishop took his case against the Antiquities Act to the Trump transition team yesterday. The Antiquities Act is the act that allows presidents of the United States to declare national monuments, which we have several of here in Utah. And Bishop asked the incoming president to consider doing what no president has ever done before, which is to undo national monument designations here in the state of Utah. He's obviously an influential member of Congress. He's the chairman of the House Natural Resources Committee. And they reported that in the meeting, Bishop discussed, and this is according to the Salt Lake Tribune, Bishop discussed his and others' misgivings about the controversial proposal by five Indian tribes and others to designate a 1.9 million acre national monument in Utah's San Juan County. So that's referring to this Bears Ears proposal. So they talked about their concerns about that. And then they also talked about past national monuments and if it's possible to undo these, to remove the national monument designation. Bishop is saying that he believes it does. It's never been done before, but that doesn't mean you can't do it.
Right.
And
so it's in, so if Bears Ears is declared a national monument within the next few weeks,
right,
it can be undone by the next administration through legal means, court means, regulatory review means. There is several different paths they have to undo that declaration.
However, not everybody really agrees that any of these are legal or possible. The Congressional Research Service, which is Congress's own research service, it's a federal group, said that no president has ever abolished or revoked a national monument proclamation, so the existence or scope of any such authority has not been tested in the courts. However, some legal analyses since at least the 1930s have concluded that the Antiquities Act, by its terms, does not authorize the president to repeal proclamations and that the president also lacks implied authority to do so. So, you know, the congressional research folks are saying this is not really an option. The same group is saying that a presidential decree of this kind would lead to lengthy litigation, paralysis, and no certain outcome.
That's what our next president is comfortable with.
Right.
Lengthy litigation.
Yeah.
You know, that's what he thrives on.
Right. For years. Kind of the fight, you know.
Right. And that's what can happen as one option to just kind of delaying, deferring the memorializing of the Bears Ear Wilderness Monument.
Right, and beyond Bears Ears, you know, some of the other national monuments that we have in the state as well.
I'm telling you, Augusta National Golf Course is going to be his first national monument. And then any of his courses around, that's what he's going to declare national monuments.
I think that Bishop is specifically thinking of Grand Staircase Escalante, which, you know, of course, here in Utah, any public land designation is always controversial. Got that right.
It's 20 years ago.
He's still thinking about that.
Gets under his skin.
Interestingly, there's also a group called PEER, the Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility. And their executive director says having President Trump take the unprecedented step of trying to unilaterally revoke monuments is guaranteed to trigger lawsuits that will likely remain unresolved during his tenure.
Right.
So, you know, that's an interesting piece. And we've also heard that potentially thanks to his sons or his family, Trump is, you know, wants to keep public lands in public hands. So this will be a really interesting one to track as it goes. Yeah. You know, as it
starting January 20th
starts to play out. Other, you know, environmental groups are, of course, saying that this is completely impossible.
Yeah.
So the other question that I asked myself when I read this is Bishop representing the point of view of his constituents?
That's a good question.
And there's a survey, and if I can just pull up the details here, if you'll just hang on for a moment.
Okay. Because it may not be the case. There may be a majority of Utahns who do support
the Bear Zero Ears Wilderness,
yep.
The establishing of national monuments, preservation, conservation like that, and it wouldn't surprise me. But that doesn't, you know, that may not motivate him.
Right, right. So this poll was carried out by the Colorado College, and what they found is, you know, it wasn't I should say that the poll took place in, I think, 6 Western states, but some of the results specific to Utah include that 96% of the respondents said an important priority for public lands management is protecting those places for future generations. 95% favored ensuring 96%. Access.
96%.
Right, right. 95% favored ensuring access for recreational activities. 70% supported future U.S. presidents continuing to protect public lands through national monument designations.
Right.
And only 20% supported the selling off of public lands to reduce federal debt. 88% believe air pollution and smog are a serious problem in this state.
All right.
So, you know, that take that for what it is. I mean, there's strong support for public lands, and it's not all specific to national monuments, but some of it is.
Right. All right. Obviously, to be continued.
Yeah, yeah.
We still, like I say, I keep saying it. We haven't started the game yet. The game doesn't start for another 6 weeks, 7 weeks. So this is all pre-game.
Pre-game
chit-chat.
Activities. Yeah.
All right. 1 minute. I got an update on ducks and the Division of Wildlife Resources. It says here, during surveys flown over North American breeding and nesting areas this past spring, biologists with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service saw 14% fewer pintail ducks than they did during surveys in spring of 2015. To give pintails more protection, the DWR biologists are recommending that hunters be allowed to take only one pintail a day. Utah hunters have been allowed to take 2 pintails a day. So half. All right. Helps them. Now, here's something else they're proposing. Another change the DWR is suggesting should make waterfowl hunting better at the Ogden Bay Waterfowl Management Area. Biologists would like to establish a waterfowl rest area at the WMA. The area would be closed to hunting. Okay. They say, quote, rest areas are great for hunting. They keep birds in areas they would normally leave because of hunting pressure. After congregating at a rest area and resting up, the birds will fly to other areas on the WMA, and that's where hunters can shoot them. They're my words. Take them.
Take.
Is the DWRs.
Is the technical. Yeah.
So rest up. Yeah. Here's a rest area. Rest up, pintails. And then fly else over here because the problems start there. All right. One last break. We got to wrap up. It's the Screen Earth.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air, Cruise, and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Park City Bike Demos, Kearns Boulevard next to Adolph's, parkcitybikedemos.com. Long, Reimer, Weininger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Time to wrap things up for this version of This Green Earth. Of course, let's thank our sponsors, underwriters who make the show possible. They include
Recycle Utah,
Republic Services,
Bacholt Landscape Architects,
yes, Rocky Mountain Power,
Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties,
San Francisco Design,
and Park City Mountain. As usual, we always would love to hear from you, so email us your thoughts, comments, and ideas at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
Yeah, and also let's thank again Dr. Brian McPherson for joining us this morning to talk about the grant he got from the Department of Energy to study the potential, the feasibility of carbon capture and storage.
Right here in Utah.
Right below the Hunterton plant, the Hunter plants and the Hunterton plants. Right,
Huntington.
That one, too. All of them, beginning with all those H coal-fired power plants. He's going to be looking at that, and we'll have him on in 18 months from now.
That's right, when end his of report 2017.
All right.
Remember, this is KPCW at 91.7 FM Park City.